I think what I would offer to entrepreneurs is the discomfort of the uncertainty never goes away. It is just your window of tolerance for it that expands.
Welcome to Self-Equity, the podcast that dives into the inspiring journeys of founders, entrepreneurs, athletes, and entertainers. I'm your host, Jolene Tepidino, authorized officer and team business manager for the Zellniger, Dorfman, Carr, and Heritage Group at UBS. Today's guest is Chelsea Lewis, founder of Loomrise Advisory. Chelsea works with leaders through one-on-one coaching and advisory engagement to help teams move faster, navigate change, and perform at a higher level. In this episode, we'll talk about how she built her career and what she's seeing among today's most effective business owners. Hi, Chelsea. Great to see you.
Hello, Jolene. It's good to be here. How are you?
All is good. Thank you. And thank you so much for joining our Self-Equity podcast today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So Chelsea, before we get started, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. My name is Chelsea Lewis. I'm the founder and principal advisor at Loomrise Advisory. So what I do is I build better organizations and I coach the people who lead them.
You're a first-generation professional. How did navigating money, autonomy, and self-led financial education shape the way you approached your career early on?
I was thinking about this, Jolene, and I think it's very funny because I didn't know that I was a first-generation professional until after I graduated college. So I didn't even know that this was a term that folks use because it's language that's used in professional environments, right? So as a first generation professional, I wasn't historically in the rooms where that type of language was being used. Inherently, in my experience, as I reflect back on my career, I made career decisions based on stability and safety, right? So I graduated not long after the 2008 crisis and all of that. So I really kind of wanted to make sure that I was safe and secure from a financial perspective. And that was really important to me.
So how did your experience in management consulting, really without a blueprint, how did that shape how you think about leadership and performance today as a business owner?
I like this question a lot. I think it's really important to kind of highlight that a lot of first-gen professionals don't have that blueprint when they're coming into the professional environment. And I think for management consulting, what I was most excited about and interested in that career path is the fact that management consultant is like, it's a string of experiences, right? It is a string of projects. And I love the idea of having a diverse experience throughout my career. But I think with management consulting as well, it is very high pressure. It attracts a lot of high performers. And I think because of that, a lot of folks in management consulting end up with this really heavy corporate armor that they put on and show up with, right? And I think as a first-gen professional, we are constantly navigating this tension between visibility and vulnerability because the stakes just feel a little bit higher, and they don't just feel higher, they actually are, because a lot of first gen professionals end up making less. They don't pursue higher education as frequently, right? So masters, they don't necessarily have as much access to networks, right, as their peers. And so I think because of that, throughout my management consulting career and working in traditional corporate environments, I have acquired this heavy corporate armor that I have, as a founder, worked to shed and help my clients shed, right? Because I'm really curious about what is underneath that corporate armor and how can we make it shine so that people can do their best work, show up as they are,
and create a high performing environment while doing that.
To that end, because it's so difficult to separate your identity, you know, of who you are from what you do,
yes,
that corporate armor, it's just ingrained in us somehow naturally,
yes,
but it's also learned behavior. So I want to get into also how you help professionals with that, how you help manage that, which I know is no easy task.
Yeah.
Being on a large team and being, you know, a professional who is very hard to rewire or unwire.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about how you made that pivot and how you got that entrepreneurial bug.
So there were a couple of moments that I would articulate as the catalyst for my entrepreneurship experience. So I'm very lucky to have a lot of multi-generational friendships. And I would say over the past 2 years, I've been having a lot of conversations with other women and asking them, what are their dreams? I'm asking that question of my friends and my family. And what I noticed from that is that a lot of people, myself included, couldn't articulate their dreams, right? Because we're go, go, go. And you don't carve out the time to daydream and really imagine different futures for ourselves. I reflected on that. I had a conversation with a friend that really struck me. And I said, okay, I need to sit down and think about what my dreams actually are. What is the life that I want to create for myself? What is potentially the dream business that I want to create for myself? So those conversations over the past couple of years has really shaped kind of how I'm thinking about the type of work that I want to do and the type of impact that I want to have on my clients and in my community. And then the other piece of my entrepreneurship journey, which I think is interesting, and Jolene, I'm curious your take on this too. I looked around, as many of us are right now, and you see the risks of layoffs and organizational changes, right? And that risk is very real. Then I looked at the entrepreneurship risk, very real and scary. But maybe a more logical person would say, you know, stay with your kind of safe, more traditional career. But this risk of entrepreneurship is going to provide the personal and professional growth regardless of outcome. So the risk that I'm seeing in the market was actually a catalyst for me launching my own business, as opposed to something that, you know, had me stay kind of in my more traditional role.
You know, there's risk factors, you know, on both. But however, as an entrepreneur, you get to control your risk a bit, right?
Yes.
Of course, there are other factors, employees, that whatever the case may be. But, you know, at least you're in the driver's seat, you control, and you know, it's up to you to make it happen. Working in corporate America, you know, affords a lot of things, right? Entrepreneurs, you have to pay for your own health insurance. Yeah, you manage your own taxes. Mm-hmm. It's all you. However,
yes,
you know, if it's not for you and you feel like you're just in a box and no matter what you do, you can't move up, you can't move over, you know, and you're just stuck, well, then that's no way to live either. There's no development coming from that. So I agree with you and I applaud you for taking that leap, because I know that it's a very, you know, exciting but scary thing to do. I'd love to know also, how did you come up with the name, Lumrun?
I'm glad you asked, because naming this business was my first big lesson in entrepreneurship. So Lumrise is near and dear to my heart. I wanted to evoke the sense of craftsmanship because my family business is home building. It's a, you know, blue collar family and all of that. So I really wanted to evoke the sense of quality and craftsmanship and hands-on and connection. But I think the lesson here was I just had to pick a name. So I work with my clients on making imperfect decisions with the information that they have. And here I was myself struggling for a couple of weeks on what do I name my business? And then it dawned on me, this is my first lesson. I need to pick a name and I need to stick with it.
And that was that Loomrise. And I you know, was grateful for that lesson, because sometimes you have to make the decision and just move on.
Immediately, you know, the name of your company, super yes. important. And yeah, I mean, that was an amazing lesson yes. for sure. But yeah, I mean, you got to take your time and really focus and think about the meaning behind it. And yes, how your baby would grow into the company, the brand, the name.
I feel really lucky, because when I left my corporate role, I did not have a pipeline. So my pipeline was zero. And within the first quarter, I was able to get back to my monthly corporate salary. So I'm really grateful for those opportunities and excited to see what's in store for Loomrise in kind of my first year here. I loved where I was working. I loved my colleagues, and they're brilliant and wonderful. And I learned so much from there. I think inherently in all of us, sometimes we get that little glimmer of intuition that perhaps we've learned all of our lessons in a space and it's time to do something new. And so that I couldn't ignore that sense anymore. So although it was hard for me to leave after 6 years, here we are with Loomrise.
So when you first started, what was, you know, one of the first things that you did, or the first prospects that you called? Did you hire staff? Do you have employees? Take me through, you know.
Yeah. Like, so I do not have any employees. I don't have intention of hiring employees at the moment. But the first thing that I did is I made a list of 100 of my warmest contacts and had conversations with them to articulate and share what I'm doing and what I'm excited about. And though I haven't worked my way through all of that list yet, that naturally led to some needs and conversations within the market. I've also found to be really, really helpful is in-person networking and in-person conversations. And in many ways, I'm so glad that there is this shift back towards analog. I'm putting that in air quotes, just, you know, in real life. And I've had such deep and meaningful conversations. So one example, I went to a local Women in Business Summit a couple of weeks ago that led to some really great connections, and not only potential, you know, client connections, but just more integration into my community in a way that felt very genuine and authentic and re-energized my entrepreneurial spirit, because it can be lonely. It absolutely can be.
Chelsea, when founders or executives come to you because things feel stuck or slower yes. than they should be, what's usually happening beneath the surface, and how do you help them get over that hump into the next level?
Yes. So what I typically see happening under the surface is that leaders, they know something is off, but they need help making sense of the complex signals within their organization. Right. So I really serve as that thought partner and advisor to help them make sense of the organizational chaos that they can sense, but they can't quite name. And so I'd work with leaders to really identify the root cause of that friction or tension or the thing that they can't name just yet. And then we do the work to fix that very specific thing. And what we also work on is the mindset and skills on how to build resiliency and adaptability within their own leadership style and within their teams. Especially in the current economy and market, adaptability, resilience, and navigating uncertainty are essential skills for people and teams. And I think there is this beautiful connection here between my first generation professional experience, because these are skills that I have naturally acquired throughout my career. And I feel really excited to kind of share them with other people, especially in, like I said, kind of navigating the chaos of the current market. Yes.
Absolutely. That's great. And I would imagine, you know, business owners, founders, they come to you thinking, yeah, this might be it. And then as you're having conversations, a lot of other things are uncovered. It's not really what they thought that they needed, but there's something else going on. How much of what you're seeing in leaders today is connected to what people are calling the millennial career crisis or the broader shifts in how we think about work? I mean, everything has changed, right?
Leaders are tired. Leaders are tired. And there are a lot of millennials who are in leadership positions now. And I think it's what I call 13th grade. And I think a lot of millennials have done 13th grade. I'll explain. It's you graduate college, you get the job, you know, you get the corporate job, you get the promotion, maybe you get the house, you know, maybe start a family or not. Great. But then you kind of you look around one day and you're like, is this my own definition of success? Is this what satisfies me? Am I happy in my role? And I think a lot of millennials are having that wake up moment right now. So I'm seeing a lot of that and having a lot of those conversations.
Yeah. Right. Especially if there's, you know, the millennial is your leader or your manager. Mm-hmm. And you know, from time to time, I do think, you know, the idea that it's important for this younger generation to take their vacations, to, you know, stop working at a certain time of the day. You know, we look at that, us older folk, right, as like, oh, it's lazy. Oh, you don't care as much. Or, oh, you know, you don't have the work ethic. It's like, no, actually, maybe we need to shift a little bit and say, hey, they're onto something, right? Because they have more of a work-life balance. They're able to manage, from what we can see, you know, the stress and all that a little bit better because, again, maybe they figured out how to separate their identity from what they do.
And I see, I'll also add, Jalene, that I'll be very curious how this shakes out. From a future of work perspective, I think there may be a third category of work that we're talking about here, right? So not just entrepreneurship and traditional roles, but this third category of people who lend their skills to projects, who are building what folks are calling portfolio careers. So I'll be really curious how that evolves and builds, especially in the age of AI. So something for us to, you know, keep an eye on and be a part of, but I'll be eager to see how that kind of shakes out over the next couple of years.
That's so interesting, which leads me to this thought of, you know, money, right? And finances. And is that the measure of success? Is how much you have, how much you earn, you know, and how the relationship with money changes over time as you become more successful and you meet those goals of buying the home and the second home and the cars, right, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, how much of it do we measure our success by, right? Mm-hmm. Our bottom line, our W-2 or whatever it might be. And how much of it, you know, is it a genuine feeling of success and just, you know, having that fulfillment for what you do and not putting a price tag on it?
I do love like how you use success there, because that's advice that I would offer, whether you want to stay in your corporate role, whether you want to be in entrepreneurship, define your own version of success, right? Sit down, pen and paper. What does success actually look like, sound like, feel like? And when I say that, it's asking yourself questions of what kind of rooms do you want to be in? What type of energy and buzz in the room excites you or kind of has you withdraw, right? I think we all have an intuition about the types of spaces and conversations and things that really energize us. What does that look like? So whether that value system is, yes, financial stability is my number one value. Great. Amazing. Make decisions from that place. But get kind of clear on what your definition of success is. Yeah.
And the financial literacy around that, right? You could just close an amazing deal and be, you know, infused with a lot of cash, right? And you have to know how to manage that, right?
Yes.
Most of it's going to your taxes, right? Then you've got to put some aside. Then you've got to invest. Then you have to say, I mean, then you have bills, or you might have some debt from starting your own business. I mean, it's not easy to just pick up one day and start a business. So what tools would you say that you came with in the financial literacy space that helped you and are helping you as you run your business day to day?
I'll bring it way back a little bit. I'll bring it way back. I think from first an entrepreneurship perspective, I think I've always had an entrepreneur bug. I remember my first internship in college, I actually converted to a $3K a month contract, which when I was in college, that was a lot of money. And from that was able to kind of save and invest and kind of grow my account so that I was able to get to a position today where I'm financially stable enough to take the leap.
We always say be prepared, not scared. So, you know, before you make moves, you know, just right, make sure you've got everything in order as much as you can and what you can control. And then just trust yourself. And look, I understand the journey has a lot of ebbs and flows. And I would also like to hear, you know, were there any times that you just thought about giving up or you said, you know what, forget about this?
Yeah. It's the question is what time of day?
I think the entrepreneurship experience is so interesting because within a day, you can have that feeling of this is going great, right? You have a conversation, and then you get more information and you're like, what is going on? I should go back to a 9-to-5. And I think what I would offer to entrepreneurs is the discomfort of the uncertainty never goes away. It is just your window of tolerance for it that expands. So I think about my discomfort as like a little monster from Monsters, Inc. that just gets to come along with me on this journey because the discomfort doesn't go away. You're always kind of navigating that uncertainty, right? And have to have that self-trust. So I operate from a place of not trying to get rid of my feelings of uncertainty or being scared in the process. All of those feelings are welcome and they just come along right with me side by side.
What are the behaviors that you see when coaching your clients and speaking with your clients? What are those behaviors that work, you know, help?
Yes.
Business, the employee, the you know, internally, like what are the ones that also hinder? Look, not everybody is going to be the first one in, the last one out. Not everyone is there for FaceTime. Not everyone, you know, can get up early or function like everybody else. We're all individuals. We're all different. But what would you say are the basic, you know, qualities and behaviors of those that are successful and those that maybe not so much?
They close the time gap between decision and action. So they're not waiting to make a perfect decision. And from the entrepreneurship side, this looks like an entrepreneur has an idea and then takes action on it. And they close that time window as much as possible because in entrepreneurship, it's so much about experimenting. In traditional roles, the same applies here is you make the decision and take the action and do your best to close that time gap. You don't have to make a perfect decision, but the leaders and entrepreneurs that I see operating most successfully understand that they need to get feedback either from their clients or from their team, right? And the only way to do that is to make the decision and implement. And then I would also say another behavior is making very intentional space for critical thinking. And what this looks like is the most successful people that I know have redefined their relationship with productivity. I think a lot of the times we think of productivity as hands on keyboard, producing that Word document, that PowerPoint, that Excel, whatever it is. But this most successful leaders I work with know that they need some blank space on their calendar to wrestle with the most complex challenges in their organization. And to take it one step further, those leaders know that they need to do the same for their teams and enable some white space on their calendars to noodle on those complex challenges. And if there are leaders listening, I would invite them to do this and see what happens to employee engagement scores, to customer satisfaction scores, to new creative ideas within your market and industry.
Gives you the time to kind of think outside of what you're doing or what your day to day is like, and, you know, really get the creativity mm-hmm. flowing and tapping into remembering why you did this in the first place, remembering, you know, the feelings that you felt in the beginning, those butterflies, the nerves, all that, right? We get so stuck in the day to day and in the thick of it and in the weeds of it that there's never any time to take a moment back and just reflect and say, hey, what's that next great idea? What is that next, you know, light bulb that'll go off?
Yes, yes. And to answer the second part of your question around hinder is what I see hindering teams a lot is leaders who are making decisions solely from self-preservation versus a place of collective well-being for the team. And I see leaders make decisions from a place of self-preservation when there isn't psychological safety within the team or within the organization, right? And that starts at the tippy top of the organization.
What are you seeing as far as burnout? You know, everyone is, again, moving 100 miles a minute. Everyone is involved in so many different things. The workday, you know, never quite ends, never quite begins. You're emailing overnight. You're working over the weekends, which, you know, could just be a product of the work that you do or the worker that you are, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe you can't finish everything by 5 p.m. every single day, so you do what you have to do to get your work done. But what are you seeing about burnout? How do you arm your clients with the tools that they need to kind of prevent that for themselves and their employees?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think burnout, there's a strong connection here between burnout and this potential third category of work, because there are many brilliant and wonderful leaders who, like we talked about, are exhausted and they want a different model. They want their weeks, months, and year to look different, because to your point, Jalene, there always seems to be more work to be done. A lot of the narrative around burnout, and this is something that I have paid attention to throughout my career, is even still sometimes burnout is positioned as solely a personal problem. And I don't believe that that is true, right? Because a lot of the advice is have better boundaries, just sign off, get rid of your apps on your phone. And I think one of the root issues is that we have incentives within organizations that are individual versus collective team incentives. And so that's what I would offer to organizations, is think about their incentive model and is it reflecting values of just individual or collective? Organizations with collective incentives typically experience less burnout.
Chelsea, for anyone listening that would like to call you or meet with you to learn more about your services and how you can help them, how can they find you and what is the process like?
Yeah, so thank you for asking. If anyone listening is experiencing that organizational friction that they can't just, you know, put their finger on, I would have them reach out to me at chelsea@loomriseadvisory.com or connect with me on LinkedIn. Just reach out, send a message, and we will schedule a call.
Chelsea, it was so amazing spending time with you today and hearing your story. Thank you so much for sharing. I look forward to seeing you continue to succeed and all the amazing work that you're going to do. And hope to do it again soon.
This is my first time sharing my story about being a first generation professional. It feels very vulnerable to talk about that, right? To a big audience. And I want to, because I want to reach other first generation professionals. But thank you guys for giving me the platform to do that, because I think it's a very important topic. And I'm figuring out how to talk about it in a public way. So thank you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.